Welcome to the Peak Work Performance Summit, where we talk about ideas that make us smarter, healthier, and more productive. My name is Ron Friedman, and my guest today is author Todd Henry. Todd is the founder of The Accidental Creative, a company that helps creative people and their teams be prolific, brilliant, and healthy. He's the author of The Accidental Creative and the host of the outstanding podcast of the same name. He also has written two other books, Die Empty, Unleash Your Best Work Every Day, and Louder Than Words, Harness the Power of Your Authentic Voice. In the interview you're about to watch, Todd offers a variety of outstanding tips for staying productive, especially if your work involves creative thinking. You're about to find out why you should avoid scheduling 60-minute meetings, how you can conserve your mental energy by batching similar activities, and why seeking comfort in your career rarely leaves you feeling satisfied. Here's my interview with Todd Henry. Enjoy. Todd, I am a big fan of The Accidental Creative, both the podcast and the book. And one of the points that you make in the book is that in order to produce consistently great work, we need to succeed at three separate domains in our life. What are they?
Yeah, and this is really tricky, right? This is the intricate balance that we have to strike. I believe that the most productive creative professionals, those who have to turn their thoughts into value every day, are a combination of three things. They're prolific, meaning they have to produce a lot of work, and I don't think anybody would argue there, right? We all have to produce a lot of work. Brilliant, meaning that they're doing good work, that they're producing work that meets client or marketplace demand. But there's a third angle that we often neglect in our pursuit of being prolific and brilliant, and that is that we also, I believe, have to be healthy. And healthy doesn't mean balanced. It doesn't mean that we have tons of space in our life and we're, you know, taking vacation every month. It doesn't mean that. What it means is sustainable, that we're producing in a way that we're going to be able to sustain the pace over the course of time. And the reality is, with all the pressures, all of the dynamics of the create-on-demand workplace, it's really, really difficult to produce in a sustainable way unless you build practices into your life, an infrastructure that supports your creative process, that supports your collaborative process, and enables you to better deal with the uncertainty of the, you know, sort of the way that work is going, I think, today for most of us, when we're having to make it up as we go.
Yeah, I think that's a terrific point. I think in many cases, I think you've actually pointed this out, is that we tend to be very good at two out of the three. We're not particularly good at all three. And so I wonder, what do you recommend in terms of being successful at all three domains at the same time?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, I think we have to build infrastructure. We have to build practices into our lives, things that feel very inefficient in the moment sometimes because, hey, I've got tasks to do. I've got projects to work on. I've got conversations to have. So it may feel really inefficient to do things like block off time to define your work more effectively, to make sure that you have clear objectives, not just objectives, but clear problems that you're trying to solve. You know, a lot of times our projects look like concepts on our task list, right? Or our tasks look like concepts. But if we've clearly defined those problems, we're setting ourselves up for success. It feels very inefficient in the moment, but it's very effective in the long run. Things like establishing time for study, for absorbing stimuli, for filling your mind with inspiring things, you know, and as Stephen Sample from USC calls it, communing with great minds. Again, it feels very inefficient in the moment, especially when you have a lot going on, but that stimuli becomes the raw fodder for your creative process, becomes the raw materials that get combined, and the throughput then is, you know are the ideas that you have. And so there are a bunch of examples of what we need to be doing to build that infrastructure, but those are a couple that maybe feel a little bit inefficient in the moment, but are very effective in the long run. We have to be careful not to sacrifice long-term effectiveness on the altar of short-term efficiency if we want to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy.
Now, you've got this other really interesting analogy in your book about how we need to think of the activities that we're doing a lot like a vine keeper tends to his or her grapes. So tell us more about what you mean by that.
Yeah, so in a vineyard, one of the primary roles of the vine keeper is to regularly prune areas of growth, right? Perfectly good fruit, by the way. Perfectly good fruit growing on that vine. We have they have to be disciplined about pruning that off, because if they don't, they recognize that eventually the vine will shoot for the median, right? Because there aren't enough resources to support that much good fruit on the vine. So they have to be careful about pruning the vine so that the good fruit, the more productive parts of the vine, are getting the resources that they need. And in the same way, as creative professionals, we don't struggle with new fruit on our vine, right? We don't struggle with new ideas, new projects, new things we want to pursue. What we're terrible at is saying no. And as you and I think both know from our work with organizations, innovation happens in the white space. It happens in the gaps between the things we think we're supposed to be doing. But if we're squeezing all of the white space out of our lives by filling it with activity, if we're not pruning, if we're not saying no to things on occasion, then we're not going to have the space that we need to innovate, to think. And that's really all about managing our energy, making sure that we're being able to create space in our lives so we can bring the best of who we are to what we do. But when we cram our life full and we're not pruning, then we're not going to have that space, and therefore we're not going to have those moments of serendipity or those insights that are just hanging there, the low-hanging fruit for us, but we're not going to get them.
Yeah, I think that's a terrific point. And I've heard it described among psychologists as having cognitive surplus. So you need to create that space in your life. And that's often what happens, you know, when we go into the shower, is when it's one of those few moments when we're not connected to our devices. And so we have that extra space to find connections between ideas. And if we're not allowing for that to happen in our lives, it's just never going to work. So I wonder, can you give us an example of something that you've done in your life that has been successful, has been down the right path, but you felt like you had to stop doing it in order to leave room for more ideas to flourish?
Absolutely. Well, I can give many examples. I'll give you one from the last year. You know, this obviously when I was leading larger teams. I mean, there are many examples of things you just have to say no to in order to be able to say yes. If you're saying yes to everything, you're really saying yes to nothing. But for me, you know, when I write a book, I really have to dedicate large chunks of time to writing, to the writing process. So I make no commitments in the morning when I'm writing a book. Now people would say that's overkill because writing, 500 words a day, 1,000 words a day over the course of several months, you really only need an hour to do that. Well, yeah, I understand that, but it's not just about the clickety-clack on the keyboard. You know, it's about all the other distractions. It's about being present in the moment. It's about making sure I'm bringing the best of my synthesis to what I'm writing. And sometimes it takes an hour to an hour and a half to gear up to really write the good stuff. The first hour is just, you know, it ends up on the cutting room floor because you're just kind of warming up, and then you really get into the good stuff. So I think in our press to be efficient, sometimes we want to squeeze everything into as small a space as possible and just, you know, crank out our best work in 5-minute increments. It doesn't happen that way. You know, we need to allot large amounts of time, which means we're going to have to say no to things. We're going to have to prune. We're going to have to carve out space if we want to be effective. So that's one. I mean, it's one example for me is just I say no to everything when I'm working on a book. I mean, I say no to interviews. I say no to lots of things, even client engagements in some instances, depending on the season of it.
One line that you had in The Accidental Creative that really resonated with me is, and I have it here, is when it comes to effectiveness, fake work is more dangerous than no work at all. What is fake work, and how do we ensure that it's not hijacking our resources?
Well, we can easily convince ourselves that we're making good progress on something just by checking tasks off of a list. But sometimes that it's fake work. It's work that gives us that surge of productivity. Things like replying to a bunch of emails or, you know, returning a bunch of phone calls. And those things can be important, but we can often hide behind those, you know, quick surge tasks and pretend like we're making progress when actually all we're doing is just swatting flies. We're just, you know, and more flies are going to take their place tomorrow. But we're not really sitting down to think about our problems. We're not really sitting down to generate ideas and to take new ground. Instead, we're just kind of protecting the ground that we've already taken. And so I define that as fake work. It's work that feels like we're making progress, but we're really not making progress on our important initiatives. We're just kind of swatting the flies. We're just, you know, sort of clearing the air today, but tomorrow that is going to fill right back up again.
Yeah, in many cases, it's, I think, the desire for the easily accomplished goal, and it's that dopamine rush of, you know, being able to check something off your to-do list, regardless of importance. And really, you know, along the course of the day and the week, the more fatigued we get, the more appealing the easily accomplished goal becomes, because we kind of lose sight of importance, and we just really focus in on how easy it will it be for me to get this done. And one of the things that we often lose track of is the value of relationships. And you talk about relationships from a different angle than I think a lot of people think of them. And you identify ways in which the relationships that we maintain and invest in can help us become more creative. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, we tend to think that creativity and innovation is a solo sport, you know, and we do have all these sort of the myth of the lone creator, you know, the myth of the lone innovator out there in a cabin in South Georgia inventing the next iPad, and they're going to come out and say, ta-da. And we only remember, you know, the Thomas Edisons, the Steve Jobs, you know, the Henry Fords, you know, these are the people that we remember, but we fail to realize all of these people had networks of people around them helping them push into those innovations, helping them discover, you know, those great products that they deliver to the world. You know, innovation is a team sport. It's the collective grasp for the next. It's groups of people stumbling awkwardly into the unknown together and sort of figuring it out. But I think our tendency when we do mind work, creative work, is we tend to isolate ourselves. We tend to close ourselves off to other people and think that we need to work on our own. So we need to be intentional about developing relationships that inspire us, that stimulate us, that force us to see the world in new ways, that fill our well. You know, and a lot of times we have relationships of obligation or convenience in our lives. So convenience meaning I work around these people, so I'll hang out with them, right? Or obligation meaning, you know, Aunt Mildred wants to have tea. But we're not building relationships into our life that fire us up, that stimulate us. So we need to be pushing out, identifying people in our lives that inspire us and say, hey, let's get together, let's have coffee, let's talk about the work we're doing, let's ask some deep and meaningful probing questions about the work, let's fuel each other with the stuff we're seeing, we're noticing, we're reading, if we want to be effective. And again, you can be very effective in isolation in the short run, but eventually your tank is going to run dry. We need other people in our lives if we want to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy over the long run, which is, I mean, that's my objective, and I hope that's the objective of the people watching this, right, is not just to burn out quickly, but to be able to sustain a great pace over the course of time.
And another very interesting strategy that you point out in The Accidental Creative is about clustering similar activities. I wonder if you could tell us how clustering works, how you use it in the work that you do on a day-to-day basis.
Sure, yeah. And again, it's going to be different for me maybe than it is for the person watching, depending on your job, depending on the responsibilities you have. But clustering is about putting similar kinds of tasks together so that you're not constantly paying a task switching penalty every time you go from something like answering an email to solving an important problem that will determine the next 20 years of our business, right? Those require very different cognitive resources, emotional resources. But many people, that's kind of what their day is like. It's fragmented. They go in, they answer a couple emails, they run off to a meeting, they come back, they think for 10 minutes about a problem they're trying to solve, then they, you know, return a phone call, then they answer a couple emails, they run off to another meeting. And they don't have blocks of time dedicated to doing that very important work that really is defining work. It's the work that's really going to create the most value, disproportionate value. So for me, I mean, again, I'll just give an example. Is, I mean, right now I mostly write books and I work with clients. I have themes for halves of my day. So, for example, one half of my day on a certain day. Now, this isn't always the case, right? There are things that come up. There are exceptions to every rule, but there are tendencies. These are things I try to do. Half of one of my days every week is just administrative stuff because we all have administrative stuff. But the reality is, for me, it would be really easy for me to sit down on a day when I'm supposed to be creating content, or I'm supposed to be writing, or I'm supposed to be working on a client project or something like that. It would be really easy for me to sit down and say, you know, I really don't feel like gearing up to do that right now. Instead, I'm gonna do this administrative stuff. I'm gonna, you know, pay some bills, or I'm gonna, reply to a couple of emails or requests or something like that. But knowing that I have a block of time dedicated to that allows me to push that off and say, okay, I'm not gonna do that. Instead, I'm gonna do the work that I know I'm supposed to be doing right now. So I have blocks of time set aside for creating content, blocks of time set aside for thinking about the marketing and the future of the business, blocks of time set aside for doing, you know, various other tasks that are necessary to what I do. So, so that's how I use it, clustering similar kinds of tasks, highly conceptual, highly concrete, so that I'm not constantly paying a task-switching penalty when I go from those concrete tasks to the conceptual tasks and vice versa.
Yeah, I love that differentiation of the concrete versus the conceptual. And I imagine a bunch of people who are watching this are saying, that sounds fantastic, but I've got to be responsive to my manager. I've got to be responsive to clients. And I recognize that we're not necessarily, as entrepreneurs, we have a lot more flexibility than some people who are working for others. And but I just wonder, like, okay, can you think of some ways in which people can still get 80% of that and apply to the work that they do when they're in a highly responsive profession?
Absolutely. So, you know, obviously people, if you're if you're a client-facing function in an organization, it's really difficult because you're often at the client's whim, right? So I get that. I also understand people don't have latitude over when they schedule meetings and whatnot. Especially if you're new to the organization, you don't have a lot of responsibility organizationally. It's hard for you to establish those rhythms. So I get that. I understand that. It could look like coming in an hour earlier, an hour and a half earlier, 1 or 2 days a week, so that you have a block of predictable time to do that work. You know, it could look like staying a little bit later. It could look like using your lunch break differently. So if you take a lunch and you normally eat at your desk, or you go, instead try to block off some time to enable you to have that kind of dedicated focus time that you need. It could look like, deferring your email to a certain, a certain time of the day. So saying, hey, between 10 and 10:30 every day, I'm going to crank through all of my urgent emails because I know I have that time predictably available every day, instead of trying to do one or two here and there, which is what a lot of us try to do in between, so that you're able then to kind of cluster your work. I had one organization that I work with that established what they called no-fly zone time between 11 o'clock and 1 o'clock every day, which meant that if you had something that could wait until after 1 o'clock, you were under organizational mandate to wait until after 1 o'clock to interrupt that person, so that they had that predictable 11 to 1 time to work on that highly conceptual work, so they wouldn't be interrupted halfway through. So again, I know it doesn't work for everyone, but it is important that you find that time. And I'm sure if we try, we probably can find that time. Another thing to do, really easy thing to do, is just to, whenever you set a one-on-one meeting with someone or a small group, instead of making it the default Outlook 60-minute, somehow we allow Microsoft to define how long our meetings are going to be. I don't know how that happened, or Google or whoever. Instead of that, make your default meeting time 45 minutes, or 40 minutes or 30 minutes. And then if you need more time, you can always say, I think we're going to need 40 for this. But instead of just saying, okay, an hour. And that allows you to reclaim 15 to 20 minutes at the end of every hour to do whatever it is that you need to do. So that you have that space. You're not going meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting, but you can refresh yourself, you have a little buffer there, you can, engage in some work during that time. So there's just a couple of ideas that I've seen be very effective.
Yeah, I really like that idea. And I think that in many cases, when you have that 60-minute block and you have that meeting and it ends up costing you 35 or 40 minutes, you feel like you've done something wrong. And that's a problem because it ends up wasting a lot of time. Speaking of using our time more effectively, one of the strategies you've suggested is taking an hour out of every week, setting it aside for deep thinking, big picture, what am I really trying to achieve with my next week? And I think it's a wonderful practice. In theory, and I think a lot of people, well, I don't want to say a lot of people, but I'd imagine that some people might feel like, what am I supposed to do with that hour? How do I get the most out of that hour? You face an hour 3 to 4 on Friday on your calendar that says deep thinking work, and that can feel a little intimidating. So what are some best practices about how people can use that 1 hour a week to position themselves to be more successful the following week?
Yeah, so again, we fall prey to efficiency at the expense of effectiveness, and so we end up drifting. We end up, moving from day to day and being carried along by the work instead of driving the work. And so really, that hour, that kind of checkpoint, we could call it, is about ensuring that we have the things on our calendar and the things on our task list and the things in our life that are really going to make us effective over the long term. So there are a couple of ways we can approach it. The first is just idea time, pure and simple, having an hour of idea time to generate ideas for your most important work. I mean, we all know that ideas are important. We all know we need breakthroughs. We all know we need to solve big problems in our organization. And yet, if you ask the average person, and I've done this, and I've worked across dozens of industries over the course of many years and thousands of people, and very rarely, it's a very rare occurrence that I encounter someone who says, yeah, I had time on my calendar last week for generating ideas. And yet, every single one of them would say it's important that I come up with ideas, I have breakthroughs. We just expect it to happen in the cracks and crevices, right? But we don't sit and intentionally think about the problems. So it sounds remarkably simple, and it is. And it might even sound obvious, and it is, but it's not what we know, it's what we do that moves the needle. So I always challenge people, put an hour on your calendar to think about your problems, to generate ideas, to think deeply about, choose one problem and dedicate an hour this week to think about it, to think about that breakthrough that you need. And again, sounds obvious, but we don't do it. Instead, we go to meetings where we banter for 10 minutes about what's going on in everybody's life and all the other stuff going on, and we spend maybe 10 or 15 minutes thinking about the problem collectively, and then we leave more confused than we came in, you know, because we haven't really made any progress. All we've done is assign next action tasks to everybody, but we don't ever really spend the time to think about the problem. So that's one way that we need to dedicate time, you know, allocate it to coming up with ideas. Again, sounds obvious, is obvious, but so many people don't do it. The vast majority don't do it. And the second thing is establishing a weekly checkpoint, like you mentioned before, where we're looking at things like our focus. Do we have clearly defined problems? Do we understand what's going to be important for us next week? So in other words, are we trying to resolve concepts or are we actually solving problems? Our relationships, who do we need to connect with? Who has not been on our calendar in a long time that we need to close the loop with, we need to connect with? Our energy, where are we spilling out over our banks in the next week, and where do we need to establish some clearly defined boundaries? What do we need to say no to next week so that we can have the energy we need? Our stimuli, what are we going to do next week in order to fill our well, in order to fire our engines? And our hours, again, we talked about idea time. Where is that going to happen in the next week? Are we doing things to develop ourselves, to develop our skills? Even though it's very inefficient, you know, where are we setting aside time to learn new things, to develop skills so that we're better equipped to deal with the problems we're going to be facing in the future? So it's also important to have that time, not just to crank out work, but to sit and think about how we're intentionally structuring our life, building that infrastructure so we can be prolific, brilliant, and healthy.
In Die Empty, your second book, you point out that in order to be continuously producing great work, we also need to avoid the temptations of comfort. Now, comfort sounds great. It sounds like, you know, making a good living, being home at 5 o'clock with your kids, maybe going to a movie on the weekend. Why should I avoid comfort?
So comfort is not bad as a byproduct. I want to be clear, because people often say that, you know, oh, you hate comfort. You hate comfort. As a matter of fact, the other day, I've got it on my desk here. I don't know if you can see this, but this was a fortune cookie that can you read that? Maybe not.
Yeah.
In life, it is best to avoid comfort, I think it says, or something like that. That actually was in my fortune cookie the other day, so that was kind of funny. It's not that I hate comfort. It's I believe that the love of comfort is often the enemy of greatness. I think it's you can get to a certain point in your life and in your career where you begin to crave comfort more than you crave doing good work. And when that happens, we begin to settle in. You know, the word mediocrity comes from two words, medius, meaning middle, and ochreous, meaning rugged mountain. So to be mediocre means to stop halfway up a rugged mountain. It means to get halfway up and say, nah, close enough. It doesn't mean I'm not skilled. It doesn't mean that I never had it. You know, I'm just blah, I'm vanilla. It means that at some point I chose willingly to stop developing myself, to stop pushing into those uncomfortable places. And I believe that people who build brilliant bodies of work are those who choose to do the right thing even when it's uncomfortable. Now, you might experience comfort as a byproduct. I mean, we're not sitting on intentionally spiky chairs all the time just because we don't want to be comfortable. It'd be silly, right? But we have to have the discipline of pushing ourselves to do uncomfortable things so that we continue moving up that rugged mountain if we want to build a body of work we can be proud of. So it's not comfort itself. Comfort is a byproduct of success, is fine, but it's when we begin to crave that comfort more than we crave doing great work. That's where I believe we start to get into the danger zone.
And you talk about mediocrity and how that happens. And it's interesting because it really is the case, as you point out in your book, that we start off really idealistic, wanting to produce amazing work. And then somehow we start to get complacent. It typically happens maybe in our 30s and 40s. And by the time we're 50, and I've noticed this in a lot of people, is that security becomes the main thing. And in fact, if you look at what people are looking for in a job, at the beginning, when they're 20 or 30, they're looking for having opportunities for growing their skills. They're looking to develop their competence. But then when you get to the age of about 50, your primary goal becomes security in your job. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that happens, how you've seen it happen in other people, and what we can do to avoid it.
Yeah, so you're right. That absolutely is a trend. It's a tendency. You know, there's definitely a trend line, I think, if you look at the vast array of people sort of at those stages of life. I don't think it's always the case. I mean, I've met many people in their 50s who are, you know, kind of going through a renaissance period where they're really reinventing themselves and creating tons of value. But I do think you're right. I think that we start to, right around the age of 40, which is right around the age that I am right now, we start to figure out, okay, there are probably certain things that are going to be taken off the table for me, right? You know, if your goal was always sort of, I'm going to be a billionaire, you know, it's like, well, okay, if by your 40s you're not sort of on that path, it's probably not going to happen, you know. And I think we start to sort of come to terms with maybe, you know, what's in the cards for us. And so some people, you know, people deal with that in different ways. People go through what they call a midlife crisis, start doing crazy things, buying sports cars, you know, whatever it is that they do. You know, but you know, some people I think start to grasp for security. They start to put their hand on the parachute, the ripcord, right? Because they know at some point I'm going to jump out and I want to make sure there's a parachute there. That's a perfectly natural human tendency to do that. But by the way, I mean, I don't know about you. I mean, I save, I invest. I mean, I like security as much as the next person. So it's, you know, I'm not advocating, no, that's silly, that's crazy. But you have to ask yourself at the same time, what am I building? You know, what is the body of work that I'm building about? I think we all start our career asking, can I make this work? You know, am I going to be able to sustain myself doing this? And then I think at some point, once we realize it's going to work, we start asking, can I thrive? Can I actually thrive in this career that I've created for myself? And I think the last question we ask once we answer that question is, will this matter? Will my work ultimately matter? And I think a lot of people get to a point later in their career where they realize they've invested a lot of time and money and all of these things into building somebody else's dream or building a career, and then they kind of get to the point where they realize they have, in little ways along the path, have compromised themselves, have compromised their value in order to gain some of that security that you talk about. And so it's not whether security is valuable or not valuable, whether you should have it or you shouldn't have it. It's what are you willing to trade in order to obtain a little bit of security? And I think that's the line we have to be careful not to cross as we get older. You know, are we selling ourselves out in order to gain a little bit of security? And in my mind, that's where regret begins to become more a part of the picture. You know, I meet many people who deeply regret decisions they've made in their career, because it seemed like the most secure, safe, comfortable decision to make. But in the end, they feel like they compromised themselves, their values. My friend Ricardo Crespo told me one time that I was asking him, why do you make decisions you do? Why have you done what you've done? And he's somebody who I deeply respect, and the decisions he's made I deeply respect. And he said, you know, I wake up every morning and I look at myself in the mirror, and he said, I've realized you can't lie to the man in the mirror. You can't lie to the person in the mirror. Everybody else, you can have everybody else fooled, but you can't lie to that person. He said, I have always had the ethic that the moment I can't go to my bosses, you know, whether that's a board of directors or if it's, you know, whatever, the moment I can't go to my bosses and say no and walk out the door, I've already failed my family. And I think that's a really interesting way to look at security. It's not about, am I going to have the creature comfort? It's about, do I have the freedom to make decisions to pursue my calling, to pursue what's being called out of me? And so, to me, that's the greatest kind of security, is knowing that I have freedom to pursue what it is that's being called out of me, my productive passion.
Right, and you know, if you think about how it is that we develop new skills and how it is that we grow, it's in those moments when we try something that we're not particularly confident in, but then use that feedback in order to get better at it in the future. And if you're not having those experiences, then you're not learning new things, you're not growing. And if you're not growing, there's just no way to be satisfied.
That's right.
Some really powerful stuff there.
Because some of the times I've been the most happy, the most joyous in my life, are the times when I've been the most uncomfortable, right? When I've sort of been out there on the edge. You know, we tend to think that stasis is when we're the most comfortable as a business or whatever, but it's the tension, release. That's where growth comes from, and that's where satisfaction comes from. That's what we're wired for as humans.
How much of that do you think is the relief of not having the tension at the end of the tension?
It could be a significant part of it, right? I mean, it could be that, you know, oh, everything worked out okay. But, you know, I think I could be wrong about this, but I think the struggle to overcome is a significant part of the satisfaction that we find in life. Even if we fail in some circumstances, it's taking a risk that we know that we need to take, even when that risk doesn't bear fruit in the end. I think, you know, we can at least look back on it and say, I did the right thing. And in the grand scheme of things, it may hurt in the moment, but in the grand scheme, I think that we have satisfaction that we made the right choice, even if it wasn't one that bore a lot of fruit in terms of comfort or security.
Your new book, Louder Than Words, comes out later this summer. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Yeah. So this is kind of the third part of, I guess you could call it the trilogy, the Creative Pro trilogy, right? Of the Accidental Creative, Die Empty, and then Louder Than Words. So the Accidental Creative is about building practices and infrastructure and all of that to enable you to deal with the pressure. Die Empty was really about, are you doing your best work, or are you getting distracted? Are you getting stuck? And so the final book is really about, how do you then take what it is that's inside of you and put it out in the world in a way that it's going to resonate with other people? You know, there's kind of this myth, Ron, that if you just do good work, if you just continue to produce good work, eventually people are going to find it. Eventually you're going to be successful. But if you look at what happens in the marketplace, that's really not the case. I mean, there's a lot of great work out there that just never gets discovered. And a lot of times it's because the person creating the work hasn't spent the time, made the effort to figure out not just what they care about, but how is their audience receiving what they're making? You know, which is a big part of voice. Your voice isn't just what you say, it's how it's received. What you hear from me is as important as what I say. So in Louder Than Words, I looked at what are some of the factors that contribute to especially resonant voices, voices that really seem to create impact over time. What I figured out is that all of these resonant voices have three elements involved. There's identity, which is a sense of who am I, what do I care about? What are the pillars, right, that define me as a person, define my work? When we talk about voice, that's often all we talk about. We say, find your voice, figure out what you care about. Well, that's only one small piece of the puzzle. That's why I don't like the phrase find your voice, because it implies it's all about a one-time thing. Oh, I found my voice. Great, I'm good for life. No. It's about developing your voice over time in context, right? So the second part of it is vision. You have to have a vision for your work. You have to understand who your intended audience is and how you want to shape that work so that it connects, it resonates deeply with that audience. And then finally, you have to master the skills necessary to bring that work into the world. So if you have a sense of identity, you have a sense of vision, but you're not skilled at what you do, you haven't built a platform that allows you to take it out, then you're not going to be credible, period. You know, you have to have the skills. So identity, vision, and mastery, they all flow together. I call it the voice engine in the book, right? But they all sort of work together in a sort of a contributive upward spiral for people who are developing their voice over the course of time. And that's what I've discovered is the key to making your work resonate deeply with your intended audience.
Interesting. You know, I haven't read the book. I look forward to reading it. And it sounds really timely because we're moving into an economy now where there really isn't very much security. And if you're going to be successful, you really need to differentiate yourself, regardless of how successful your company is today. It could be bought out tomorrow. You have no idea where you're going to be 2, 3, 5 years from now. And so really identifying some of the ways that you can stand out and really take that entrepreneurial spirit and incorporate it into the work that you do. That just seems like something that we should all be doing.
I agree. And it's not, you know, when we talk about personal branding in general, we tend to think about the outward shell. How am I presenting myself to the world, right? And that's not the same thing as developing a voice, an authentic, compelling voice. It's very different because eventually all of the efforts to position yourself will fail if it's not coming from a place of genuineness or authenticity. So the first step, when I talked about identity, the first step is to get in there and figure out what are the battle lines that I'm drawing? What are the things that I really care about, right? What really makes me unique and defines who I am? What is the value or the change I want to create in the marketplace? That really has to come first. It has to be rooted there. And then you can move on to, okay, how do I take this to the marketplace in a way that is going to shape and define a group of people? What's going to make me unique? What's really going to help me stand out in the crowded marketplace? But it all has to begin with that place of authenticity. You can't fabricate that. And the best, most resonant voices come from that rooted place of authenticity.
Well, Todd Henry, this was so interesting. Thank you so much for your time.